You've got a very biased person there, and for Ferg and Paul, it's probably it'll break soon, but there's a serious bromance going on there. There was an awful lot of questions when we were in camp about, I don't know, were one or two of them slipping over to each other's bedroom at night. They were very, very close.
House of Rugby Ireland, here on Joe. Game changed.
Hello and welcome to House of Rugby here on Joe. I'm Eimear Considine and I'm joined in studio by Fergus McFadden and former Munster and Ireland scrum half Tomás O'Leary. Tomás, thank you very much for coming on the show. You travelled up from Cork today to watch the game. Even as a retired player, your wife still can't get you home on Valentine's Day.
Yeah, look, we've been together long enough, so she knows not to expect any grand gestures. I think she didn't miss out on too much anyway.
No, unfortunately, it wasn't the match we were hoping for. I had a chat with Ronan O'Gara during the week, and that'll be coming up later on the show. But first, we'll get straight into it. A disappointing loss for Ireland again, their second loss in the Six Nations. That hasn't happened since 1998. We thought we'd be coming here tonight, you know, all positive. It's very happy to be positive after that.
Yeah, that's not a great start you're after saying there, but at the same time, they're two really tough matches as well. And two narrow defeats. Today probably went a lot better than people were expecting as well. I thought that the first half showing was really positive. They were unlucky not to score in the corner with James Lowe at that stage. He almost finished that try really well. And, you know, that would have changed the complexion of the game going into half time. I think the French then had one opportunity and they, you know, score that try from you know, playing that nice free-flowing, offloading play from that line-out. So, that probably just knocked the stuffing out of the lads a small bit just before half-time. And going in and being down by, I think it was, 5 points when they probably should have been leading at half-time, I'd say.
Yeah, it's a difficult start knowing that, you know, Ireland had gotten the score sheet 3-0 up. Billy Burns got Ireland into the game and Ficou did amazingly well to, like, inches. It was only a matter of inches, really, that his foot was on the line.
Yeah, it was. It was very unlucky, really. Obviously, we did very well to create a space from a line-out maul and the Gibson Park released the pass at a good time. And obviously, the little move to create space out wide for Lowe. It was very well executed. And unfortunately, as you said, it was inches from Ireland being up 8 to 10 points versus France having a line out to clear their lines. So that's the kind of small margins. And like, given all the kind of territorial and possession dominance that Ireland had in the first 20, 25 minutes, unfortunately, we didn't make that tell on the scoreboard.
So it's one positive of today is the set piece did look really well. They managed to rob some of the French lineouts, but also, you know, were pretty dominant in both scrum and lineout today.
Yeah, I thought, look, you'd see probably Paulie's influence on it. Even the simplicity of, you know, saw a few of the calls were just one word cues and they went and got clean ball from whatever 4 or 6 of the lineout. Kind of also disrupted the first 3 or 4 French lineouts and turned it over. Unfortunately, then was the 4th or 5th French lineout where they've got clean ball for the first time. They eventually went on to score off that phase. So, yeah, there is I suppose shoots of hope and improvements there. So definitely all is not lost, and it's a second narrow loss in a week. So if we had taken maybe different opportunities in either of the games, then we could be here with an entirely different scenario. But look, pressure is definitely kind of mounting on this Irish team to get a victory.
Yeah, like it's those moments, like had that try been scored at the start, maybe France wouldn't have, you know, they got spurred on almost by the Ireland missing that try, and typical French style just went down the field and killed Ireland, like put the hammer into the coffin when, you know, it would have been such a joy for Ireland to score that try. Then, as well as that, Ireland, you know, things didn't go their way. Like, that's a certain moment in a game that would have been very important, but also key personnel in the game. It's super important to have everyone there. And 3 guys went off for HIAs at the exact same time. Like, that's just another blow kick you when you're down.
Yeah, I think the French were very clinical. And then, you had Keane and Ian Henderson colliding heads at the start of the second half and losing your stand-in captain for Johnny, who was doing a great job. He was having a great game. And Keane, such an experienced player in the pack, like that's you talked about the team being disrupted before going into the game. Like, you know, when that happens to experienced guys during it, it's not ideal either. But I thought they rallied well. I thought Ed Byrne and Ulton Delan played very well when they came on, actually. I thought the scrum maintained to be strong, and so did the line out. But I thought the most impressive thing from the game, from just like a neutral's perspective, was the French defence. I just think that the French defence has been, it's been better under Sean Edwards, but this, I think, was one of their best performances. I think there was a clear message for them going into the match just not to go after the ball on the ground. And I think they were hitting us on the gain line or behind the gain line, and then just leaving the ruck dead. So they had 14 guys on their feet, so that they were very difficult to break down in that weather.
So was it people criticising the Irish lack of, you know, creativity, that Ireland looked very flat in attack, but could it just have been that the French defence were just phenomenal? There's a blue wall in front of you and it's impossible to get through.
Yeah, the French defence was absolutely very impressive. And as Fergus has said, under Sean Edwards, they've made serious strides in that department. Look, I think you can see the difference between the sides was effectively France's ability to offload, either, you know, in the contact after they've had a dominant carry, or when they've gone through the contact. And that's again just down to sheer size and power of the ball carriers. And unfortunately, we didn't have that ability to break through the line and offload in the tackle. We did manage to create an opportunity around them for James Lowe's try. So you can see that we have the creativity to do it. But I just think it's down to sheer size and power and ability to get through that tackle or dominate that gain line and offload. So that essentially was the difference for me between the two sides. And because we didn't have that ability, because France dominated the tackle line in the defensive side of their ball, I think that was the telling component of the game.
It's not like Ireland have small ball carriers. Like, they're not lacking in the strength that you were saying. Like, they couldn't get past the gain line. Like, what do Ireland need out of their attack then? It's a tough question.
Kind of, yeah, it is a tough question. If I knew that, I'd be coaching Ireland, I suppose. But it's difficult. I think, you know, at test level, when the defences are coming off the line that quickly in wet weather, you know, against that sort of a defence on a dry day, you see what England have done to Ireland with that rush defence over the past few years. They're tough to break down. But maybe a little bit more of what Tomás had just mentioned. You know, I think it's great for the players to have structure, whether it's in attack or defence, but to be looking for, you know, to get their hands free and make that offload. I think there's just times in those really tight test matches where that bit of magic can change. You saw the Wales-Scotland game at the very end. Finn Russell managed to flick that ball out to Van der Merwe on the wing, and he got tap-tackled. But, you know, that just created space that wouldn't have been there if he did that. And I think, you know, I'm not saying that guys should have been throwing the ball around the place because you don't want to turn it over, but you saw the benefit it had for the French when they could just get through, even in the second half, when they made that break. The guys are catching the ball and they're just looking to shift it straight away, even when they're making that, punching through the holes. So a little bit more of that.
Here's what Andy Farrell and Ian Henderson had to say about the game.
Unbelievably proud of their efforts. There was a lot of lads that are hurting in there, mentally and physically, by the obvious work rate, work ethic, putting the bodies on the line for the country, etc. But at the same time, you know, test matches are there to be won, especially at home, and we rue a few decisions that we made, stroke chances along that way. So even though a couple of days ago people were writing us off, we never wrote ourselves off. The game was there to be won, and it was a hard-fought contest, but it's one that slipped away from us in the end. Our approach, our attitude doesn't change. I just said to the boys in the changing rooms there that you know, we talk about the strength of the group and the togetherness of the group and how close they are, etc. We'll see how close we are now, because we'll show our true character, won't we? Because it's about finishing. We're not even halfway through, but making sure that these next three games were at our best. And again, that approach doesn't change no matter what.
We're not taking the opportunities that are presenting themselves for us. I felt we were in good positions a lot of the game, and I also felt that more so than France, but France got their opportunities and they took them. Everyone's striving for it. Everyone's working real hard. There's a huge amount of frustration. We're definitely seeing guys putting in the time. Everyone's trying their best to produce this progress on the pitch, but I think it's that last couple of inches, it's that last wee bit that we need to see just push it over the line. It's almost like in rugby, speaking in terms that I know, you get up into the opposition's 22 and you get up there, and it's those last couple of meters that are actually extremely difficult to get. We're working hard. No one's going to give up, whether it's coaching staff or players, to continually push to get this. We've had two games this last couple of weeks, and both of them, I think, could very, very easily have gone the other way, and we'd be sitting here with a completely different mentality. So I'm proud of the work the guys have been putting in, and I'm looking forward to working together going forward to see those strings of hard work coming together.
From a defensive point of view, so the French defence was excellent. What could Ireland have done better?
I think our defensive performance was pretty decent. We didn't really get opened up too many times by this French team. You saw their first score. It was basically a couple of fantastic offloads from their half-backs. Suddenly they were in behind. Quick ball to the other side of the pitch, bit of width on the ball, and it was just maybe a poor decision by Gibson Park to hit in. But again, it's back to the two offloads making the difference and getting them 5-10 yards. Suddenly, when they move the ball to the other side of the pitch with width, they're forcing the Irish team and the Irish defenders to make decisions. And majority of the game, Irish defenders got those decisions right. A majority of the game, Irish defenders stopped this French team getting momentum. So there was only kind of two or three line breaks of any kind of note that I can think of. Obviously, straight after half time as well, the French probably should have scored. But aside from that, you know, we probably managed the game pretty well, and our defensive game was good.
Last week you spoke about that, you know, that I suppose the exact same position James Gibson Park was in, and James Lowe was in that position last week, and like you have to make a decision as a defender. You're either going man and ball, or you're bowing out of it, and you're just waiting for it. And I suppose that decision, it didn't work out well again today. But James Lowe, we spoke about last week, he actually had 7 attempted tackles and 4 missed. Like, that's not a good enough stat as a winger. You need, especially when, you know, tries to score down your wing.
Yeah, he probably wouldn't be proud of that stat. I mean, he brings so much to the team in attack, and his kicking today is such a huge weapon. Yeah. I think I said that the last day, like, he must have one of the biggest left boots in the world. Particularly after Rob Kearney leaving, having him in, and he can just relieve that pressure. So some of his kicking was great, but yeah, it's difficult on the edge at test level. You can get exposed. I mean, I've been exposed, you know, plenty of times at that level when you miss a tackle and you might only have 3 to make, but you miss an important one. It's for a try. Whereas people forget that in and around a ruck, from like the first defender to the fifth, the spaces are so tight. If someone misses someone in there, a prop or a lock, they'll get cleaned up by someone else. Whereas the guys on the edge, whether it's the 13, the 15 or the winger, you miss tackles there, there's going to be tries because guys are so quick and there's much more space to run into. So, I think people will, he'll probably look back at the clip of, James will probably look back at the clip of where Doolan steps in. Again, a very tough tackle for him. He's lunging there. His weight isn't underneath his feet, and he's just trying to grab him. He steps in and manages to flick it to Damien Penaud for that important try. So it's tough. I don't know exactly what the system is that Simon Easterby has them running, but it might just take a little bit more time for James to get used to it.
Yeah. Do you think that's the reason James stayed on the field? Earls got subbed off and Larmour came on for him. Was it because of his left boot, do you think?
Yeah, look, that was definitely a weapon that, particularly in the first half, he utilised very well. He's also incredibly good going forward physically with the ball, and probably didn't see enough of it in his hands. And you could argue as well that, you know, the other danger man on the wing, Keith Earls, didn't see much in attack as well. So hopefully you can see the game plan evolve where, boy, you're getting your threats, whether that's James Lowe's physicality or that's Keith Earls' feet or whatever it is. So you're utilising the strengths that your wingers have. And look, he did incredibly well to nearly finish the try. He was very unlucky. So I think he will, like other wingers like Penaud there, physicality he has, James Lowe can offer that and can offer something different maybe than the Irish wingers that we have outside of him. So I think he stayed on because he was doing okay. Obviously, he did miss a few tackles and like his kicking game was decent, but they just wanted to bring the X factor that was on the bench on and give them an opportunity to change it up. That's what you have a subs bench for. And, you know, this management was just trying to utilise that. Certainly, I don't think James Lowe was played a very, very poor game today. I thought he did well enough.
Yeah, I think so. And like you said, Keith Earls, for someone who didn't get on the ball, I suppose, much in open play, really, he more so got a good turnaround off the kick receipts and did very well under the high ball today. But as someone who's played with Keith Earls, both of you have played with Keith Earls, like as a winger, you know his strengths are his step and his pace. And why are they not getting the ball to people like James Lowe with his power and his strength, and people like Keith Earls and his footwork? And like, why are we not putting them out there to show off what they can do well?
Well, we did it in the first half. We put James Lowe into space and made a credit try. The French team didn't do that straight off offset play. So if you want to analyse that, the Irish set piece and the Irish first phase play was better than the French today. So we showed we can do that. Why are we not doing it enough? Because it's difficult to do. Because at that level, defensive teams are so, so good. The jump up from your Heineken Cup, from your provincial level to international level, and you'll know this as well, it's massive. The space is just cut down. Your time on the ball is cut down and the sheer physicality of it is increased. So that's probably why we're not doing it, because it's very hard to do. It's easy when you're sitting here like us or you're watching from home to say, oh, our 10 should move the ball more, or we need to get the ball on the wings more. And that's probably where Joe Schmidt was a master, is he's 3-4 five set plays where he was bringing the full back in at an angle or bringing the winger in an angle and get these guys on the ball. But it's the reason we're not doing it is because it's very hard to do. I'd love to see Kidderas on the ball more. I'd love to see James Lowe use his physicality more, but it's just very, very difficult to manipulate defences and I suppose exert your influence as an attacking team onto the game. International rugby is just difficult.
So the French didn't really do that either. As in, Pinot scored that try, but the French didn't. They get the ball at their wingers' hands at all. Their wingers were making some good reads in defence.
Yeah.
Definitely, Doulin did extremely well under the high ball for the few times we test them in the first and second half. But they didn't get the ball to the edges either. So I don't think we can be guilty of that. But I think if the weather is better towards the end of the championship against Italy, I hopefully will be able to, you know, make a couple of changes with a bit of personnel. Without disrespecting Italy, let's hope that'll be a nice confidence builder for us leading into the last two tough games of the championship, because, you know, they've got to reset themselves now. It's been a tough couple of weeks, you know, off the back of a strange week with two or three really important players for this group to be taken out, all that stuff in the media about Johnny, which was probably a bit of a distraction, and then a couple of, you know, calls for key positions where there was still, you know, a lot of people talking about it. I think they fronted up really well, so just disappointing to lose again.
You spoke about the Italian game and going ahead, we have to look towards that Italian game. Who would you like to see involved or been given a chance in the next test game?
That's a difficult question too. I think I thought Gibson Park did very well today in terms of tempo, and particularly even when the game was in the melting pot at the end. You know, he had a couple of fantastic catches, a couple of offloads and stuff. So thought he was lively and he set a good pace. It'd be good to see Craig Casey get a taste as well. But I was impressed with Gibson Park. I think Byrne did well at 10 when he came on.
Yeah.
And probably like to see the likes of maybe a Jack Carty or someone get an opportunity too. So those two guys probably, Jack Carty and Casey in at 9, probably look at probably utilising someone else as a number 8, as an alternative to CJ. He's played a lot of minutes over the last few years. We know what he can do. Look, he's been a fantastic ball carrier, and he's going to be in our starting back row, probably at 8 or 6. But I'd like to see someone else given a chance at 8 against the Italians, just to see what other kind of balance we could have in the back row as well.
What about you, Frank?
Yeah, I think you'd imagine he might cap a couple of those guys for the first time. that could be a good energy booster for the group. And those guys, you know, Craig Casey and Tom O'Toole would be two guys who could get an opportunity there. You know, I would like to see a couple of changes, but at the same time, because the first two matches, unintentionally for them, have been pretty disrupted, they probably want to keep a couple of the combinations as well. So I doubt they're going to ring in the changes because, you know, Italy made it quite tough for England, actually, in Twickenham for a lot of that match. Yeah. So, you know, I do think we'll beat them, but we don't want to take them for granted. We need to get a bonus point now. We need to beat them by as much as possible. So they'll still be picking the very strong side.
Yeah, exactly. Going back to the Welsh game, or going back to the French game today, was there, I suppose we've talked on the bad stuff, but was there any positive that we can take, like any good performances, any standout players that you thought, you know, did really well today, really stood up to the challenge and I suppose took the game by the scruff of the neck?
I think a positive is France are really considered one of the top two, three teams in the world at the moment and have a bit of form, so they have momentum. Yet, we had a chance to win the game right up to the end, so we were very, very competitive. Our defence was good. Our, as you said, our line-out set piece has improved. From a personal point of view, obviously looking at with my nine hat on, I thought Gibson Park had a very, very decent performance.
Difficult to play a full 80 minutes as well.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. I thought Reece Ruddock in the first half was particularly good as well. So it's definitely encouraging signs, and it shows that we're not a million miles off, as well as, you know, you're missing your first choice halfbacks. And you know, there's other kind of key players, Ryan obviously missing from the pack as well. So to go into it, to give other guys some experience, especially fresh halfback pairing into a game of that magnitude and really, really be competitive, I think that's very, very positive.
Were you happy with the halfback partnership and how Billy Burns did and the influence that Ross Byrne had on the game when he came on?
Probably the wrong man to ask here, to be honest, on this one. But not really, just I wouldn't, you know, I think that Jamieson had a brilliant game, really, and I thought that it was great to see Billy Burns bounce back. I think once he settled into the match, he did well. But I also do think that Ross Byrne played brilliantly for that last 10 minutes that he got. Yeah. I think that we probably got the ball to the edges a little bit more, and I know we were chasing the match, but we got the ball to the edges a little bit more, and, you know, we were a lucky enough bounce for Ronan Keller, but he played brilliantly when he came on as well. That got a, like, that turn of pace he had, you know, some of the form he's had for Leinster, it's got to be up for grabs between him and Rob Herring leading into, if he gets his chance against Italy, you'd think it could be competitive for that Scottish match between for the hooker spot. But it was great to see the likes of Reece Ruddock, you know, play particularly well. I think that he has been left out in the cold for a long time by Ireland, and he stood up and showed the type of player and guy he is. That was probably, you know, probably nervy before that game. He hasn't played for, started for Ireland Six Nations in an awful long time. And he had an awesome match.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, great stuff. We will take a short break and chat about the weekend's other games and chat to Tomás about some of his best Munster memories and maybe a bit of GAA too. But before that, earlier this week, Aviva launched the Safe to Dream team, an online hub which aims to improve access for young people on their sporting journey within clubs or at home through online skills, videos and advice and support from leading sports ambassadors. As part of that Aviva Mini Rugby Virtual Skills Hub launch, I got to chat with Ronan O'Gara about coaching, how he is getting on back in France and about Paul O'Connell joining the Irish setup.
So Ronan, welcome to House of Rugby. Delighted to have you on. You've been on the show before, but it's great to have you back on. At the weekend past, you had a Cork reunion on Sunday with Simon Zeebo. Unfortunately, it didn't go your way at 26-22 away loss to Racing, and you guys missed the chance to go on top. How have you been finding it in La Rochelle so far?
Yeah, it's been going well. It's been going very challenging at times. I spent obviously 4.5 years at Racing, so I was aware of the French Championship and the importance they put on it, and I suppose squad harmony being the big one. Then you go to Crusaders, where to give a little bit of context, I was, I left Munster for 16 years as a player into coaching a lot of world-class players at Racing, so out of your debt, but hanging on by your fingernails about trying to give a better impression that you know more than you do. And as we know as players, you know your job and probably the, your nines job and 12s and back rows inside out, but there's the bigger picture stuff of 1 to 15, 1 to 23 is very, very new to you. So it takes a while to get your head around that. So I was very lucky to get the opportunity in Crusaders to get into a world-class environment. And it genuinely is that. It's the words wouldn't do it justice, but it's, I think I've been re-energized, reinvigorated with knowing what real what's best for the team mentality looks like. You don't get that in personal development trips by going visiting places around the world for a week or two. I was absolutely convinced for probably the first 4 months that, because there was rumours when I was in New Zealand that I was there as a kind of a spy for Irish rugby, and what's this about? But like, for people that know me, kind of, thankfully they know I'm quite ambitious and I get struck into whatever job I'm doing. And I was kind of beginning to wonder, are these guys holding back here? Like, what's the magic potion here? Why is it everything they're talking about so simple? But that's what New Zealanders believe in, the simple things doing well. And to give you an example, it's the capacity to run straight and pass the ball. You watch so much Northern Hemisphere rugby and so many people think that the try line is on the touchline. So it was just, I was made aware of that probably in Racing with Dan Carter, but then to get it on a daily basis and seeing how you can train that in the Crusaders, that made it great for me. And just, you know, I was definitely glass half empty person. Now I'm definitely glass half full, because I believe in growth mindset, and I've lived the growth mindset, and I know what that looks like, and I know what, you know what I mean, numbers 12 to 17 of the backs, how, if they feel engaged in a project, that everyone will benefit. And it was really, really powerful.
And do you think you've found your feet now in relation to that coaching capacity?
Yeah, I do. I do. I think I'm not far away from hopefully, you know what I mean, completing that jigsaw mentally. I think the massive thing I got from the Crusaders was I needed to taste it. I needed that confidence to be, for me, there comes, I suppose, in all of us, something that have to convince, because as you know, life is probably, it's you against you, getting the best out of yourself. So how do you do that? And because of my background and because of coaches and because of maybe the time I played the game in Ireland, the All Blacks were grown up, were made out to be guys that were the best ever and untouchable, and were lucky to take the pitch with these guys. Nonsense. But unfortunately, if that's your mindset and that's what's been hammered into you from a young age, you'll always feel a little bit inferior. But now, thankfully, I don't. And I feel on a level playing pitch. I know what their weaknesses are. I know what their strengths are. And I just, I suppose, have a great sense of contentment with having, you know, not talking with a big head, probably earning their respect. And that's important too, because, if, you know what I mean, the great thing about the rugby world, it's small and they all talk and they'll know whether you did a good job. But I'm really connected to so many of their players now that I felt like I was there for way longer than 2 years. And I think that's hopefully a compliment to both of us.
You spent a lot of your career both playing and obviously coaching in France, but what, you were clearly happy and content over there, but what spurred on the move back to France?
I think opportunity and the fact that I love coaching both sides of the ball. I don't know, do I prefer, you know what I mean, being an attack coach or a defence coach. In La Rochelle, I get the opportunity to do both. So that really, really makes me feel great. I love it because, you know what I mean, I was an average tackler, but I think I was a good defender in the fact that I know what opposition out halves like and don't like. So I apply that to everything I do. So I set up teams with, you know what I mean, for the example of I give would be Bowden Barrett. If you give him time, he'll rip you apart. You can't give Bowden Barrett time. So the key is, if you got to double mark him, triple mark him. But for me, I always felt like when the ball isn't in Beauden Barrett's hands, my team has a better chance. My team, i.e. Razor's team, has a better chance of performing. So you've got to be smart about how you do that. But if we always think the same about certain things, we'll always get what we always got, which is the definition of insanity. You know what I mean? To do the same things and expect a different result. So, sorry. 20% battery, my fault. So from that regard, it was to go back there was to, so I could continue not being put into a box of being responsible for this, because I love big picture too. I love the connection. I love the empathy with the players. I love knowing how they feel. That for me is what sport is about. We're not pushing robots around the place. You know what I mean? We all have bad days. You feel some days the game is so simple. You look at the example of, you mean, goal kicking or doing any skill, you can be doing the exact same technique and with your eyes closed, you can kick the ball over. Then there's other days, a penalty on a 15-meter line on the 22, you're like, oh God, this post looks so small today. What's going on here, you know? So it's about, I suppose, creating an environment where you give your players the best chance to succeed, because in my time in Munster, I was made feel 10 foot tall by certain coaches. Other coaches probably squeezed me, and then you get that experience with going on Lions tours where you come across the best players and the best coaches, and you take a little bit from everyone, and now it's your time to have a go at it.
And going back to those coaches that made you feel 10 foot tall, like, what attributes would you try and replicate as a coach? Like, what did they do to you to make you feel that way, for coaches that may be listening or watching on?
Yeah, I think you've got to load your players with certain tools or a framework where I'm giving you this framework where you play the game, but I don't ever want you to be robotic, and I'd really like you to trust your instincts. But defenses are organized, Emer. They're very much in your face. So, you know, you can't just go into a game with a willy-nilly plan where we'll have a look and see what's on. Because, you know, you try playing Itoja every week, and people have that level. You have to have a plan. You have to back the plan. But I suppose my big one would be trying to have a philosophy where we have a framework, but within the framework, you've option A, B, and C, and it's up to 10 to pull the trigger on whichever one he wants. So I always put myself in that 10 role, or the second receiver role, or first receiver role. And from an attack point of view, there has to be space somewhere. Who's identifying space? If there's one fella, the number 10, looking for the space, you're not going to be effective. If you have a Doug Howlett who opened my eyes about the attack game, or a Tupoki outside you, you're made look like a genius at time, but like, I got all the credit, but like, I just laughed to myself with the boys afterwards in the bar going, thanks, Dougie. Thanks, Rua, because they were calling stuff on the run, like in terms of run kicks, or just push me on an overs, hit me inside shoulder, and you get to him. It was just talk on the run is so important. But I just love the daily challenge of trying to get the best out of people, and you're dealing with tight head props to wingers. We're so different in rugby that's why, you know, that you don't have a response or a solution for everything, but players will admire you by saying, okay, yeah, he's not a know-all, put up his hands there, come on boys, I need a few suggestions here, help me out, you know. So we got to have a collaborative approach to things. Yet we got to wrap it up at the end of the week and sort of, it's discussed, we decide and we apply.
You make it sound so simple. You're running straight and passing and communicating. It's the stuff that, you know, we're taught. It's said how many times.
But are we taught, Emer? I don't think we are taught. Yeah. Because what we've done in the Crusaders opened up. So you know how a rugby pitch is lined traditionally. But for us in Crusaders, every 5 metres, there's red straight lines painted on the pitch. Because you get players who will go, I'm not drifting on that pass. What are you talking about? So you don't do anything. You just go, all right, we'll just have a look here at the laptop. So, okay, so the line is moving. You're not, is it? If you understand me, you know? So it was brilliant. Just the power of the image or the video is so much more. And if you can do that live where you have, you know what I mean, a session that can get coded on the run, and you do have a water break, and you come over to your portable van, and you have the screen there, and you can go, okay, this is what straight line looks like. This is what looks drifting on the ball, you know. But it sounds simple, but it's probably the hardest skill in rugby, I think. I'm finding anyway, is people's capacity to stay square and pass.
Yeah, absolutely. It's definitely something that people can, I think a lot of people will take something from that conversation there about the lines, and you never know, we might see some other pitches with different lines in Ireland very soon. Another Munster man who's obviously continued on his coaching career is Paul O'Connell. Again, very new to his coaching career, but you said, you know, coaching is more than just, you know, coaching robots, and Paul probably is someone who players will benefit. They will respond well to someone like Paul and his impact that he will have on the forward pack.
Yeah, I think there's a misunderstanding. You know, I'd be a little bit worried if Paul was going in as head coach of Ireland, because he doesn't have those experience of, you know what I mean, what is experience? Experience is putting yourself in the same situation and getting a better result or outcome the next time. So, but he's doing a role which he's very, very, very good at. He knows the subject matter inside out. He is so well prepared. He's very hard working. He's got a great brain. He's got a very good attitude. He's got many sides to him that a lot of people don't know. And I think it's a great time for any forward to be involved in Irish rugby. That's how I would view it. This guy is very, very special. I've come across very, very few people like him in the world. And I've travelled a bit with coaching. He's obviously a very good friend. But, you know what I mean, if parking that, I think, in terms of judging him, he can call it too, and he can give you the harsh truth, but he can also be very, very warm. A very warm person to you, and a very encouraging person, and a very smart person as well, which is important. People are, I suppose, associate hardness and ruthlessness and fear of God with Paul, but that's 1% of them.
Yeah, even chatting on last week's show with Ferg and the boys, they're saying you want to do it for the coaches. You know, when you want to do it,
mind you, that's
change.
That's you've got a very biased person there, and for Ferg and Paul, it's probably. It'll break soon, but there's a serious bromance going on there. There was an awful lot of questions when we were in camp about, I don't know, were one or two of them slipping over to each other's bedroom at night. They were very, very close.
I'll have to get Ferg's comment on this yes. To get a reaction to that comment there.
Oh, yeah, it was a table for two with every time we were out for squad dinners, table for two, yeah. So they were very, very close.
Very good. I'll have to ask him about that one. I suppose, as Proud Munster people, we have to be delighted with the, I suppose, the academy structures and the structures that the upcoming new boys that have really stood up, you know, when the internationals were away over the Autumn Nations and stood up in the Pro 14. How have you been enjoying the rugby that Munster Rugby are playing at the moment?
Yeah, it's been very exciting to watch, obviously, because of, you know, coming from West Cork, a lot of them, it's obviously a big traditional football county. And these guys are making their mark on the team, but their time is now, and it's good. And you need guys like, Craig Casey and the two brothers putting their stamp on it. And Gavin Coombs could potentially play this weekend now. Yeah. So I think the great thing about it is they're ambitious, and they need to be, because that was always the strength of Munster, was local players. We the province bought quality imports, but like I think what was absolutely crucial, the heartbeat and of the team was local boys, and that should never change, because if you know what I mean, the reality is you got to love who you play for, and you love a place I think more if you're from there. That for me is non-negotiable, but it is good to see they're taking their opportunity, but they've obviously got a lot of mentoring and support up to this point. And it's very hard now with the European games, I suppose, being taken away from them to see, you know what I mean, or for us to even call about who would start for Munster in their first 15, because they have competition for places, but do you really need that? And you saw glimpses in the Leinster game that Munster were on top, but they didn't finish it, and that's the next challenge they'll face.
Yeah, absolutely, Ron. It's been a pleasure to chat to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Emer. Cheers.
House of Rugby Ireland. Tell us what you think by comment and rating us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify and Google Podcasts.
So lots of good stuff from Rog to get stuck into there, but I think everyone will want me to start on something he touched on in our chat, Fergus and Paulie's bromance. So what's that all about, Ferg?
I don't know. I think we probably just got on a little bit better than him and Johnny did back in the day. So he probably couldn't understand that from a Leinster and Munster perspective.
So he's more just a little bit jealous is all.
I know, we did get on well, in fairness. Yeah, we would have had a good player and friendship relationship.
Did something happen in that World Cup in Wellington?
How do you mean?
Was there something that happened on that night, you know, that really spurred on that sort of a bromance?
This is obviously come from his book, is it?
I don't know.
No, there wasn't really anything that happened. I remember hearing something that was in his book. I haven't actually read Paulie's book, to be honest, but so basically when Ireland got knocked out against Wales, it was in Wellington, and you know, obviously the management wouldn't have planned that we were going to get knocked out in that game. And so the flight wasn't actually back until the Monday. The game was on the Saturday. So everyone was pretty dejected back at the hotel, because that was a team of, you know, guys like Gordon Darcy and Dricko and Paulie and Leamy and Rog and just guys that had been through a very successful period with Ireland. That was kind of their chance after disappointing 2007. So we got back to the hotel, it was pretty grim and guys were pretty down. But there was a bit of a sing-song and a few beers, and I sang the Rock and Roll Kids is the song I sang. And I'm not a particularly good singer, but I sang it anyway to get a bit of an atmosphere going. And that night we were out anyway, the team was out, and there was Irish fans everywhere. In fairness, the travelling fans were unbelievable. And there was obviously, there's a lot of expats, I think, in New Zealand, or must have come over from other countries, surrounding countries, and so the following was unreal, and obviously it was good crack with them out and about. But because there was so many people everywhere, me and Paulie got separated from the team, so he was talking to this old man, and he was kind of pointing at me to come over and chat to him. So we went over, and there was a guy called Brendan Graham, so he actually wrote the Rock and Roll Kids, and I just sang it for the boys that night.
No way.
I just destroyed his song earlier on that night, and he was an absolute gent. And we got back from the World Cup anyway. We're back with our provinces, and one I got this this A4 envelope thing in the post around a month later, and it was like an original manuscript from him, signed by him and stuff.
Unreal.
And he sent one to Paulie as well, so it was a pretty cool one. But I think That's my PC story for the show.
Okay.
I don't know what story the Paulie has, to be honest.
I actually know. We'll have to look at the book and find out the real story. But did you sing Rock and Roll Kids for him? Did you butcher it for him in front of him?
I actually didn't bother, no.
No, you didn't join in on a duet or anything?
No.
You didn't. Rog tells us, we're just chatting there, he tells us about, you know, how difficult he found it coaching at the start, and how he had so much to learn, and that he learned so much along his journey in New Zealand in particular. You played with Anthony Foley and played under him as a player, and you also played with Leo Cullen and under him as well as a player. How difficult is that, or how strange is it to, I suppose, take the friend and player hat off and change it to a coach?
It wasn't difficult for me personally, because, look, I suppose even if it wasn't been picked by Axel or whoever it was, you know, I can understand. There's probably reasons behind that, more related to my own personal performance rather than making it a personality thing. And Axel was always straight up. Whenever he wasn't picking the air, you know, there was no kind of bull with him, really. Like, he called a spade a spade. And that's what I found the best coaches were like that. They didn't make up excuses, or, you know, they didn't pick statistics or whatever. They said, look, prefer this guy, or I think he's playing better, or whatever it is. So for me, from my own point of view, it wasn't kind of difficult for me playing under Axel. I haven't played with him. And I think that setup actually, you know, Mick O'Driscoll was one of the coaches as well. Fla was one of the coaches. Felix ended up being a coach. So
yeah.
I would have had four, I think, in one coaching setup at a time that I had played with. So it just became the norm. Still had the personal relationship with them. But obviously, you respect their position as coach. So, yeah, look, and on to Roger's point, I think probably the benefit that he has had is he's gone to different cultures, and Maybe, you know, if Axel did it again, you know, he might have left Munster and got an appreciation for a different way of doing things. And then obviously the players evolved and you're onto a new breed of people, and, you know, people learn differently, people play differently. So, you know, he was probably harping back to the Munster team that he was part of, and, you know, I suppose their standards and the way they did things, and maybe that wasn't as applicable to the group of players that he inherited. And I just think, as well, in terms of ability, that the playing group that unfortunately Axel had wasn't as good as the previous generation. So all of those things combined to make it a difficult time for Axel, unfortunately.
Does your relationship change from the player to when he steps into that coach position?
Of course it does. Of course it changes. Like, I would have, to be honest, an awful lot of coaches in Leinster I would have played with at times. You know, there would have been Leo Cullen, obviously, but even Guy Easterby is part of the management. You've got Trevor Hogan, then Felipe, obviously. So there's a number of guys there. So, yeah, but and Leo being the boss man, there was obviously awkward conversations because we had a very good relationship as players in the same change room. And then all of a sudden, he's my boss, and, you know, we're talking to each other in a different way. There's just a different dynamic, and there has to be when he's the director of rugby, and there's just a barrier up straight away. I think, you know, there's an upstairs and downstairs in Leinster of, like, the staff are upstairs and the players are obviously downstairs, and you get on great with the staff. I've got some brilliant friends from the staff that I have from there, but there's always a barrier up, and I think particularly the higher up the food chain it is, like, Leo's picking the team, so he can ruin your week. So when he's coming up to tell you, not tipping on your shoulder, which unfortunately was happening to me a little bit too often.
It wasn't just for
towards,
a chat.
Towards the end of my career, it just changes the dynamic. And for a day or two, you dislike the guy a lot. You're like, how is he doing this? And how is he picking him ahead of me? And he knows what I can do. I've been on the pitch before. But that's why I think it's kind of hard to... You just can't put yourself in their shoes because you've never been in there. But I'm sure you cross the other side of the fence and become a coach. It must be such a difficult thing, because I was only the player that looked at the person that was the coach that used to be us. But he's almost like for him, I'm sure, it's like, it's such a tough thing, because I'd say he wants to still be your friend in a way, but he just can't be, you know what I mean? But it's a very difficult thing to manage.
Yeah, it's his job at the end of the day, I suppose. One of the players that I played with used to be our manager, so, like, just, I suppose, the organisational side of things, and often you tell her stuff and she's like, do I have my friend hat on or do I have my manager hat on, because her reaction would be completely different based on whichever one she is, and you'd have to specify that this is just me telling you as a friend or this is me telling you as a player, and it's a completely different conversation and reaction based on what hat that they have on at any particular time.
I remember there was when Leo, though, closer towards the end, I was like, I was getting picked less and less, and say the Heineken Cup matches, and, you know, there's some weeks on a Monday you would know maybe how training was set up that you were probably not going to get in or something. So the way Leo does it is he comes down on a Tuesday and he starts, so the backs do a weight session and the forwards do a weight session, and then vice versa, you do meetings at different times. So when the backs are down there, he'll come down wandering around and he'll be tapping everyone on the shoulder. And if you get a tap on the shoulder, it's not good news, it's bad news. So sometimes if I kind of knew, I'd see him coming, and it's a big open plan gym, see him coming, I'm going to make it tough for this fucker now when he starts coming after me. So I just start sifting in and around. If he's getting up close enough to a group that I'd be close to, I'd just kind of meander down the other end of the gym and act like I was doing an exercise, and then I'd go somewhere else. And you could kind of see him kind of coming. So
I think every group is the same with that. I think there's always some sort of a selection process, and you know you're going to get the curly finger and you don't want to get that. And it's avoiding people and going into different rooms, so they have to go and try and find you, which is never... Actually, one time they forgot to tell someone their shoe was dropped. It wasn't good. I suppose we did so much dodging of the coaches that they actually forgot that they never told her she was dropped, and the team was named and she hadn't been told she wasn't playing. So there's dodging for a good thing, and then there's dodging for a bad thing. Mm. We'll get cracking into the other matches of the Six Nations this weekend. Gutted for Scotland, I suppose, in the performance that they had, that, you know, a 24-25 loss. You know, they were down to 14 men, a very similar situation. Wales scraped over the edge just like last weekend. Scotland looked like they were doing well, looked like they were well ahead until that red card, and then it kind of went downhill from there.
Yeah, like, to go up so handsomely early, and to, I suppose, surrender that lead to Welsh team who have been struggling, they'll be very, very disappointed. Scotland, the tries that they got in the first half were beautiful, particularly the little chip from the nine.
You appreciate that.
Yeah, it was really, like, just totally off the cuff. And, to open up a defence. And I suppose we talked about Ireland struggling to open up the French defence, where we kicked a lot in the first half. There were a lot of high bombs, so maybe a little different kind of attacking kicks might have been better. But Scotland illustrated how to utilise those little attacking chips perfectly well, and they just looked like a team, in high in confidence, high in form, under a management team who were encouraging them to play. Like, their both of their wingers looked really, really dangerous. Obviously, total different statures. One massive man, South African, and a really diminutive, skillful, but very powerful winger on the other side. And then I suppose their number 10, who is kind of a maverick, really, and when it comes to it, can produce the sublime, but also, you can see the Heineken Cup final last year where he made a few mistakes. So, but they're a team that's kind of high in confidence, and it's not going to be an easy place for Ireland to go to try and get a victory this year.
Definitely not. What about the red card, Ferguson? A very similar, I suppose, one to last week's one, that it was a clear out of the ruck again, illegally done so.
Hmm. Yeah, I think it was a fair enough red card. I think with the rulings that are in at the moment, any contact with the head from your arm or shoulder is just going to be a red card. And it's just difficult for guys, for Peter O'Mahony the week before and then Xander Fagerson.
Yeah.
I very much doubt that either. And I know Fagerson ran in from, but he was just trying to clear the guy out, and things happen very, people's body height and position change very quickly in rucks when they're being flipped in different positions. And he was kind of, I think Hogg was trying to flip him off, and his head popped up, and Fagerson just, unfortunately for him, caught him on the head. And he'll be kicking himself, because if they had 15 players, I really don't think they would have surrendered that lead, as Tomás said. But fair play to the Welsh for hanging in there. And they've been dogged the last few games, and they're not going to be easy to beat for the French or the Welsh now. French or the English.
A few weeks ago you mentioned Rhys Ammitt, kind of relatively unheard of, new to the Welsh scene, but he has really put down a mark in the last few games.
Yeah, he has. He's like, his finishing has been, exceptional. I think that one where he chipped the ball over Hogg's head,
burned Van der Merwe before he even kicked
but,
it over.
And I know that Hogg is, he was turning, but he just glided past him. He looks like a proper sprinter, and he's got that kind of balance as well, where he can step, and he's obviously a nice footballer with that chip. So, I think I watched him in an interview afterwards, and the guy barely has any hair on his face.
He's just 20 or something.
Just turned 20.
He looks about 16.
Proper teenager.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
So,
my wife was like, "What age is that guy?"
I know. So he should have a really bright future. I think if they can get North back. And I'm not sure how badly the centres are injured, but if they could, pull a bit more of a back line together, they will get tougher to beat, I'd say, as the competition goes on.
Yeah. What is their chances of winning a championship like?
I don't think they'll win a championship, but you fancy France at this stage. But Pivac was under savage pressure coming into the Six Nations, and all of a sudden they're 2 from 2. And like Fergus said, they're going to be very hard to beat. They have a bit of momentum. A lot of experience, kind of galvanised by Alan Wynne-Jones in the second row. And I thought Faletau was unbelievable. His work rate as well was fantastic. And like you said, the wingers now, Rhys Ammitt and Liam Williams, and obviously Bigger went off, and they made a big call to in the 10th position with 25 minutes to go. So that illustrates a bit of, ambition by a coach as well. So they're a very experienced side, but they're starting to, I suppose, bring in a bit of youth and a bit of sparkle as well. They had Johnny Williams, who played against Ireland, went off with the HIA. He's a fantastic player too. So, while I don't think they'll win a championship, you probably can't dismiss them either. And all the experience they had under Gatland, under Sean Edwards, that kind of told in the game against Scotland on the weekend.
Do you still think there's more in them, though? Are they still only in second and third gear? They've won the last two games, scraped the last two games without actually playing particularly well.
No, I think that's just going to be the way they're probably going to play for the rest of the competition as well. I'd imagine they'll put a nice score on Italy, but the games against France and England are going to be seriously tight matches as well. So
you were saying the Welsh are never easy to win against.
Yeah, I don't think they are. And I think before the show we were talking about maybe how good a win that was for Ireland in the autumn, beating the Welsh by that much, because the Welsh are a very tough team to put away. Even in that World Cup in 2015, when the Welsh were down by, I think, around 10 points against England, they came back and beat them. And they kind of have that fight. And I know that's one example, but they always have that fight where they never give up. And I think the likes of Alan Wynne-Jones and Dan Biggar, they've obviously got a good culture there. And they're still only finding their feet under the new coaching ticket of PVAC. But when you say, can they win the Six Nations, you definitely couldn't rule it out with the way the results are going these days.
No, absolutely not. What about the English game? England 41, Italy 18, a bonus point win for England and a couple of great tries scored by Anthony Watson and Johnny May. But it wasn't all plain sailing for them with Italy.
No, the Italians, I suppose, illustrated glimpses of what they can do with Ioane's try after whatever couple of minutes it was. And England kind of stuttered for large periods to get on a momentum. But like you said, Anthony Watson showed how dangerous he is in broken field and beat the last defender easily for his try. And Johnny May's finish was pretty ridiculous as well. So I guess that X factor that they have, along with the power game that they can exert. I know they probably had one or two injuries, and they've had a few injuries and a bit of disruption to their team. But I suppose chopping and changing at 10 as well hasn't helped. And probably the lack of real competitive game time that the Saracens lads have had, that kind of probably told in their first game. And they kind of probably brought remnants of that into the Italian game as well. Probably need a probably viable alternative as well to Ben Youngs at this stage. Look, he's 100 and whatever, four or five caps, unbelievable servant for England. But Dan Robson did okay when he came on, but they really need a real alternative to push on at nine as well, I think.
Yeah, talking about nines, Owen Farrell actually hit the Italian nine late and it went actually to TMO, but they deemed it that it was fair, but it was a no-arm tackle he had a no-hand tackle last week on Vandermeer, and then again this week he got, one of his tackles were highlighted. You played obviously against Owen Farrell a lot. Is this a common trend of his, or is it just unfortunate for him?
Well, he gets a lot of stick. He obviously had that high tackle where he clotheslined the guy against Wasps when Saracens lost lost him last year before they played Leinster in the quarter, even though they still beat Leinster. But so he does hit guys high. He hits guys very hard. He's probably one of the biggest hitters for a 10 since Johnny Wilkinson. He really does have, I think, he's very brave and extremely physical, but he does get his timing off sometimes. And I'm not so sure, to be honest. I think it's more because it was Owen Farrell, people were talking about it afterwards. The one against Italy was much of a muchness. Like, it was nothing in that.
It's his reputation at this stage, really, isn't it?
A little bit. And, we've all been there where you're having a bit of a bad run and you're involved in you get sin binned or this dirty play, and sometimes you just need to let it settle for a while. But it's obviously such a high profile guy, and there's been a couple of instances that there's a couple of yellow flags down, like kind of looking out for him, but I wouldn't have said there was any intent behind it.
No. A few younger lads in the current squad, Tomás, obviously Craig Casey is a nine. In your own experience coming up through a nine, and obviously focusing in on nines, what's the current scrum half situation like at the moment in the Irish setup?
I think it's pretty good. Probably the issue has been that Murray has been so far ahead of anyone else for the last 10 years, really. And there's been, I suppose, he's obviously been fit and well for a majority of that too, so thankfully we haven't had to test too many other guys. But I suppose the drop down in standard was pretty significant. Look, we're talking about whatever two or three time line tourist. He's got whatever 80 odd caps for Ireland and won how many Grand Slams. So I suppose the fact that we got to see Gibson Park play well today, I think, was positive. Craig Casey looks so exciting for Munster, and all the vibes out of the camp are really, really positive. Like, the forwards love playing with him because he's so energetic. He gives direction. He demands so much of them. So they love playing with him. And obviously, from a spectator point of view, from a fan point of view, you know, just the energy and the speed he gets to the breakdown. Obviously, the issue is there. We haven't even seen him play European Cup rugby. But I guess Farrell and the management team in Ireland wouldn't have picked him if they didn't see something in him and if they didn't have the right sound bites coming from the Munster camp, Munster coaches. So that's extremely positive there. Obviously, then you've John Cooney up in Ulster.
It looks like John Cooney's third choice. He was there as travelling.
Yeah. Like last year in particular, he was unbelievable. And I suppose that was the opportunity for him to maybe get a cap. And unfortunately, for one reason or another, he didn't get a cap. Luke McGrath has won how many Heineken Cup titles, how many caps for Ireland. So I'm a big fan of Luke McGrath's as well. So I think we're in a very, very healthy position in our nines. And it's probably now just time to, I suppose, figure out who is number two to Murray and hopefully give that number two a chance to really push on and be a viable alternative come the next World Cup.
Ferg, isn't it mad to think that it seems like Luke McGrath is almost fifth choice scrum half at the moment? If you look at the pecking order, like, you've obviously Connor and then obviously Jameson Gibson Park, Craig Casey was third choice there, John Cooney was in as travelling extra, and Luke McGrath isn't even there.
I couldn't believe it when the squad was announced and he wasn't in. And, you know, I'm sure there's a lot of Ulster fans out there as well that were disappointed that John Cooney was in, but from a, you know, for me having my Leinster hat on, I would have gone, how is Luke McGrath not in there? And I know you want to bleed, you know, you want to bleed guys through, but you want to win the Six Nations. You want to win your matches in the Six Nations. And I think that you need to have your best guys in there, because you saw Connor got injured and then Craig Casey comes onto the bench. You know, would Andy Farrell have used Luke McGrath from 60 if he was there? I think he would have. I think the only reason he didn't bring him on is because he hasn't capped him before. They're only losing by two games. So you need to have every player in your Six Nations squad that you'd be willing to put in on a really big day in a really tight match. And I think that he probably, you know, Gray Casey hasn't played to that level yet, so he was never going to put him in there. So I think that was an example of maybe selection. You know, I would question selection of Andy Farrell there in the starting point of the entire squad. And I realise that he's trying to, you know, he is looking to the future, but, you know, I just hope that Luke will get another chance before the end of this campaign.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, like you said, you have to have the backing of every single player. You're going in playing against France. It's not like you're playing against Italy or Georgia in a test, a warm-up game. You know, it's a Six Nations game against France. And you probably didn't back Casey enough today to bring him on. But as a young guy, you've been there. You both have been there. But as a young guy coming on as a nine, you know, on the bench, how excited, obviously disappointing Casey didn't get on the pitch today, but how excited and how much of a big moment is it for him, or what would it have been today for him?
Yeah, it's disappointing not to see him come on, really. And Ferg probably made a good point. You know, most international teams really utilise their bench, and particularly scrum half, given it's, I suppose, such a demanding position in terms of meters run and everything like that. So maybe that bit of energy might have given Ireland a bit of a bounce. So maybe that is a criticism you could point at Farrell. But from his own point of view, Casey, look, he's obviously grown up wanting to play with Munster, grown up wanting to play with Ireland. And he'll have, I suppose, you know, yourself, when you're young, you don't really consider it in any negatives or any possible negatives. It's all positive. It's all, you have that ambivalence and, I suppose, naivety of youth that, you know, everything's going to go really well. And thus far in his Munster career, everything has been brilliant. So I think he would have just been hoping to get on the pitch and, you know, get on that green jersey and show what he could do and illustrate what he can do. So look, I've no doubt we'll see that in the Italian game at some stage, whether they decide to start him or whether they bring him off the bench. So look, I just think it's incredibly exciting for him, and it's probably an area we've criticised Irish coaches and in the past is not picking lads who are inexperienced with their provinces. Like, I'm kind of on the fence really with it, because I like to see lads earn their stripes as well at European level. And I think I'd agree with regards to McGrath. Like, I thought he was unbelievable in the second half against Munster, you know, the day before the the selection was made for Six Nations squad. So I just think he's a fine player, a great player as well. But it's encouraging to see the Irish team look to the future as well. And I can't wait to see Craig pull on that Irish number 9 or 21 jersey.
Another talking point based on, I suppose, the last few games has been the amount of head injuries that have happened in the game. As dads, you both have children. Would you be happy with your children playing rugby?
Sure, Tomás was only saying before we came on that he's struggling to remember stuff.
I don't remember playing a Forag.
That's
a difficult one, and it's obviously something I've given thought to. It'd be good for, I suppose, the RFU or World Rugby or whatever to issue a joint statement, a medically based statement as to the risks that are, I suppose, inherent in professional rugby, inherent in amateur rugby, the maybe potential effects, like whether it could be early onset amnesia, whatever other effects that you increase by playing rugby, by participating in rugby. So if we get the full information as parents, then it's up for us to maybe sit down with our kids and say, look, we think you know the benefits of playing rugby, we all know that socially, physically, what we've gotten out of the game is unbelievable. So I don't think I deprive my kids of that, but it'd be certainly good to have the information as to what the actual effects are. And as former players, and I went into the game in 2005 as well, you know, maybe what the risks are long term for us as well, it'd be good to know that. But it's hard to say I'd stop my kids from playing rugby if that's what they want to do. I think I would let them play rugby. I hope my kids play sport, because just the social benefits and the developmental benefits that they get from that are massive, I think. And obviously there is going to be risk associated with whatever sport, but particularly rugby, obviously, given that it's so physical. So it's a difficult one, and I understand that certain parents would have very, very deep concerns with it. But hopefully, you know, similar to the American football, they try to issue statements as to make players aware of, if you compete in this sport, you're taking this risk. It'd be great to see World Rugby follow suit.
I think the risk is there in every sport, though. I know personally I've got more concussions playing Gaelic football than I have in rugby. Maybe that's because I'm a winger, but, you know, it obviously the people in the forwards will take a lot more hits and will make a lot more tackles than we will out on the wingers as a fullback. But there's risks involved with every contact sport that you play.
Yeah, I think so, but I suppose the data so far doesn't read very well for rugby. You know, there's not too many Gaelic footballers that are coming out and saying that they've got dementia in their early 40s, and there's a lot of people, you know, Tomás is talking about the NFL guys there about lawsuits. I think it was like 960 million. So, if a few of these lawsuits go through from these guys that have gone forward from England and France and all the rest, the unions just wouldn't be able to survive that sort of, and it wouldn't be the same amount of money, but it's all relative to the amount that you're paid and the unions have. So a little bit worrying from that perspective. So that would be kind of an interesting space to see how that pans out. But I suppose as a parent as well, from what you're talking about there with Tomás, I'd agree. You know, I got so much from, and as you have as well, Emer, so much from playing the game, I love team sports. And I think rugby particularly is, it really bonds you with people. You know, you go through a lot, and it's so much more physical than, you know, a hurling, or I know the hurling and football are physical games, but they're not as physical as rugby. You know, you're properly in the trenches with guys and games and girls, and I think you can get great bonds and friendships. And I think there's great traits that you can, bed into youngsters from the game as well. So taking them out of the game would agree with Tomás in terms of getting more data on the damage and hopefully seeing maybe different laws and protocols brought in where they, you know, really narrow down and make things even safer in the game.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, hopefully they will do a lot more analysis on that, and hopefully the head injuries will, that they'll stay on top of the HIAs and all the protocols around that at the moment. Tomás, how's the dancing going? Have you kept it up since you left it?
Are you offering services area.
I don't think.
Give her an old twirl there. Give her a twirl.
I don't think I'd be very good.
Are you a bit at the ballroom dancing, are you?
Not into it at all.
That's my speciality, actually.
We were doing that Jerusalem dance. Do you know that dance that's going around at the moment here in camp today? And like, you should see everyone trying to dance. We're not dancers.
Yeah, it's tough,
isn't
it?
We're rugby players. We're not dancers.
Yeah, I'd agree.
I appreciate what you did.
I was never a dancer and I'm never going to be a dancer again. So it's good crack, but...
How many weeks did you last?
3.
Tough, though, I'd say.
It was tough, like, but it was just difficult, like. The ballroom dancing, I think I found my niche. I was very good at the ballroom dancing. Did a good jive, too, but I forget the name of the dance that I got knocked out on, but I was terrible.
You hated it anyway, whatever it is.
Yeah, I was terrible at it. I
thought the outfit suited you, actually.
Yeah, thanks. I enjoyed that aspect
Showing
of it.
Showing off the guns, man.
Greg, it's your next now. You're retired. That's the next thing for you.
Yeah.
Sign you up.
2 chances.
I think he'd love it.
So we're going to move on to the best of social media. We thought it'd be a great idea to look at something that caught our eye on social media this week. That could be something funny, thought-provoking, shocking or downright brilliant that we've seen on Twitter, Instagram or on our House of Rugby Ireland Facebook group. There are lots of images of Johnny May's diving try against Italy doing the rounds, but it was interesting to see our old friend Nigel Owens weighing in on the matter. When Jim Hamilton tweeted, "You can't jump over a tackler," it'd been a very poor match for the officials, unfortunately. Nigel replied, "You're spot on, Jim. You can't jump to avoid a tackle like that. To dive in to score a try is fine, but he jumps up to avoid tackle here, which is different." What's your thoughts on that try?
Yeah, look, obviously Nigel Owen knows the law book better than I do. It's a difficult one because the tackler hasn't got a fair chance to tackle him, so... I didn't actually know that law, but if Nigel Owen says it, then it should have been a penalty to Italy, and they should have had a chance to clear their lines. Because remember, it wasn't one of the Lions tours. It was a pivotal moment as well, where one of the lads jumped into the tackler last minute, and they got a kick. I don't know what tour that was, but you shouldn't be allowed to jump into a tackle, really. So yeah, I'd agree with Nigel. I'd tip my hat to him there, and obviously he's a lot more knowledgeable than I am.
Kind of a bit of a technicality, though, in terms of, yeah, you can't jump into a tackler, but, like, can you only jump from a certain period towards the line?
Yeah.
You know, because he's got the choice of jumping there. And can you only jump a certain height?
Yeah.
You see Ashton jumping in the air that high.
Yeah.
Because, you know, even though there's not a tackler there,
yeah,
you know, he's got the choice to jump. And I think that, I think it's fair play. I think it's a brilliant try. I think you just got to give that try. You can't really, like, if a guy is coming in around the ruck and he is jumping or trying to jump over the ruck or someone there, that's obviously jumping over a tackler. But I don't think in that instance
It's not like rugby to have any grey area, is it? Like the ruck time or anything. But like in that case then, as well, in the Scottish game, whereby they made that little line break at the end, then I don't know who it was, but did a tap tackle. But like tap tackle isn't trying to wrap your arms in a tackle, so should that not be a penalty?
Yeah.
Technically,
if you're reading the rules book.
Yeah, like, so there's so many grey areas, but look, Nigel Owens, he obviously thinks it's not. Does he know more about rugby than Ferg? I don't know, so we'll see.
And finally, Keith Rawlinson shared a funny video of Italian sub Palazzani taking Luke Cowan-Dickey, then flinging his boot away afterwards. So whatever works for you, and there's a video of that here. Cheers to everybody for watching and listening today. A big, huge thank you to producer Pat, Paul, Dermot, Anthony and everyone that has helped getting this show together. Also, thanks to Tomás for coming on. This has been House of Rugby Ireland here on Joe. Slongful.
House of Rugby Ireland here on Joe. Game changed.